Chapter 22. Welcome back, Swami. Over the 4 months that the Swami was away, our congregation increased and our programs got bigger. We had long, energetic kirtans 4 nights a week, which were attended by musicians, meditators, and other spiritual seekers. The mridanga retained its place of supreme importance in the kirtan, but its rhythm was supplemented by numerous other musical instruments, especially the few pairs of kartala cymbals which we had acquired from India. Because the temple was growing, I decided it would be a good idea to have some kartals made. Importing them was a headache, and I figured it couldn't be that hard to make a few pairs of hand cymbals. The Swami said kartals were made from gun metal, but I had no idea what that was. I grabbed a copy of the Yellow Pages, found a metallurgy lab, and walked over to see about getting the kartal's metallic content analyzed. The coolie hat-shaped kartals clanged together in my pocket as I walked. The metallurgy guy drilled out a few small shavings from the underside of one kartal. "I'll do a quick spectroanalysis of these shavings," he said. "Then I'll be able to tell you what's in them." He came back 10 minutes later, carrying out a printout, which he handed to me. "It looks like the symbols are mostly brass," he said. I glanced down at the printout. 80% brass, 17% tin, and the remainder a mixture of zinc, mercury, lead, and manganese. So that was gunmetal. "Do you think we could make something like them?" I asked. "You know, buy the metal and then cast, mold, or forge them, or whatever you do." "Sure," he said. "There's lots of places that would do it, especially if you find the stuff yourself." I did some research and found out that buying brass and tin was expensive. So we scoured scrap yards for old brass ship valves and used refrigerator tin coils. Guru Das and I loaded everything into the trunk of Shamsunder's green 1952 Chevrolet and drove it over to a foundry in South San Francisco, operated by a Mexican guy named Godoy. The plant was a large, hot Quonset hut with cauldrons of red-hot and white-hot molten metal. Mr. Godoy was just the way I'd pictured him from his telephone voice, heavy-set, kind face, and covered in soot. "Hi, I'm Mukunda," I said, reluctantly shaking his filthy outstretched hand. "I called you about making the symbols." "Hi," he said in a thick Mexican accent. "Let's have a look at them." I pulled the kartals out of my pocket and handed them to him. He turned them over a few times and ran his stubby fingers over the surface as if he was trying to get to know them. "Yep," he said, "I can do them." "You can? That's great." "What kind of metal you got?" he asked. Well, it's all in the back of the car," Gurdas said. "You want to see it?" "Yep, and I want to weigh it," he said. We transferred the metal to a giant scale, piece by awkward piece. Godai pulled a grime-streaked notebook out of his pocket and made a few calculations. "I figured you can get about 100 pairs out of this," he said, gesturing toward the pile of twisted coils. "I cast them in sand." He put the pairs of kartals in his pocket. "I need to keep these to copy." I looked at Gurudas for confirmation. "They were one of our best pairs." He shrugged. "Okay," I said, "but please take care of them." "You betcha," he said. "I'll make the mold, and then you can come back and see before I cast." A week later, Guru Das and I returned to look at his mold. It looked like a waffle iron and could make 3 sets of kartals at once. Godoy unhinged the shallow metal trays so we could see inside. The upper and lower trays were filled with hardened sand. The kartals would be dropped out of the mold when the metal hardened. When I collected the 100 sets of kartals 10 days later, I was a little bit disappointed in the way they looked. Each symbol was a lot thicker than I would have liked, and the edges didn't taper to a thin edge like the ones from India. They also looked dingy. I sat in the car and tried out a pair. The sound wasn't exact, but it was okay. Back at the temple, a few of us burnished the kartals with commercial brass polish until they shone like gold. They looked so much better than when I had picked them up that I decided then and there to show them to Jay and Ron at the psychedelic shop. They liked them and agreed to sell them on commission. For the sake of marketing, we found some white cardboard boxes, which we lined with white cotton padding. I bought a large piece of thin scarlet felt, which I cut into strips and used as a handle for each set of symbols. The felt was soft against my fingers, and I knew it would make a comfortable handle with which to hold the kartals as they were played. Finally, I made an instruction manual, printed on thick textured paper of a light blue shade. The manual included the illustrated explanation of how to hold the kartals, techniques for forming different sounds with them, music notation for percussion rhythm beats, and the words of the mantra. Yamuna and Gurudas helped me fold the manuals and fit them inside the boxes. The kartals fit perfectly in their white cotton beds with their deep red handles. Each polished set looked like jewelry. Ron and Jay said they would sell them at $10 a box and keep a dollar for each set. Not bad, considering the whole package of each unit, kartals, felt, cotton, printed instructions, and box, cost us only $3. Sales were brisk. Within a month, the shop sold 90 sets. I kept a couple of pairs for the temple and one pair to show the Swami when he returned from India. I couldn't wait to present him with the first pair of American-made kartals. Although we did our best to maintain the temple, as though the Swami was still with us, we all missed him a lot and wondered when and where he'd return. Soon after he left us, we were surprised to receive a letter from him that said he was missing us, too. "My dear students," he wrote, "please accept my blessings. I am always thinking of you, and I am feeling separation. I wish to return at the earliest opportunity. I cannot stop my Western world activities, and I have taken leave from you for only 6 months, and it may be that I will come again to you soon. So continue your activities with great vigor. I shall always pray to Krishna for your steady advance, but try to follow the principles which are necessary to strengthen oneself in the matter of spiritual advance. Never think that I am absent from you. Physical presence is not essential. Presence by message, or hearing, is real touch. Lord Krishna is present by his message, which was delivered 5,000 years ago. We feel always the presence of our past acharyas simply by their immutable instructions." This letter cast a new light on the Swami's apparent absence from our midst. He was present with us in his instructions, and we could be with him through hearing his message. Each time he wrote to one of us, he informed us that his health was improving, and each letter spoke of his intent to return to America soon. In October, the details of the Swami's return began to become more concrete. He wrote to Janaki about his intention to honor her request that he return to San Francisco. "I am trying to fulfill my promise," he wrote to her. "As you asked me to go to San Francisco while returning from India, I am thinking of going directly to San Francisco." Finally, in the third week of November, a telegram arrived. "Arriving San Francisco at 12:45 p.m. December 14, flight PAA-846. More when we meet. ACB." 55 devotees drove out to San Francisco Airport to greet the Swami that cold and windy but sunny Thursday. We were all excited, but I was also worried that the high winds could make it difficult for the plane to land. The plane circled the airport a couple of times before making a rocky landing on the runway. We pressed ourselves against the bulletproof floor-to-ceiling glass that barricaded us from the customs arrival area. I was breathless with anticipation. The passengers began to trickle out into the customs area. A tattered youth with a red bandana on his head, a woman in a maroon wool coat, a man in a suit carrying a briefcase, an exasperated-looking mother dragging two whining children by their hands. A few cleared customs quickly, and a few had to lift their luggage onto the white ceramic counters for inspection. Then the Swami was there. I felt a lump in my throat and my eyes blur with tears. Around me, I heard gasps and cheers. The Swami saw us immediately. He beamed and waved, and a muted cheer went up from the greeting throng. He looked fitter and thinner than I had ever seen him, happy, agile, and sprightly, much younger than his 72 years. In his beige turtleneck sweater and saffron robes, he shone with radiance. As he got in line at the customs counter, I noticed that even his walk was animated. Only a pane of glass separated us from him, but it was hard and soundproofed, so we couldn't hear what was going on inside. The customs official rifled through the Swami's hand luggage, where they found some small brown bottles, which I assume were the Swami's medicine. The customs inspector held a couple of bottles up to the light while he talked to the Swami, and then led him away from the counter. The Swami looked back at us as he followed the official away. He nodded as if to say, "This won't take long. Don't worry. Everything is all right." After 5 minutes, I grew impatient, and some of the other devotees were getting angry. "Why are they hassling him like this?" Murari asked. "God, it's just his medicine." "Maybe they just want to analyze it," I said. "I mean, they don't know it's just Ayurvedic stuff. It could be anything." I was trying to be reasonable, but inside I was panicking. Drug use in the Haight-Ashbury was now a major social problem, and it spread to the whole San Francisco area. Barbiturate deaths and drug-related killings were increasing. What if they thought he was a smuggler in a clever disguise? What if they arrested him? Another 5 minutes went by. What if they confiscated his medicine and he had a relapse? The Swami bounded back into view, talking vivaciously to the customs agent. The official helped him reassemble his carry-on luggage. As he zipped up the Swami's bag, he nodded and laughed at something he said. The Swami accepted his arrival card back from the agent and handed it to a uniformed woman as he passed through the large automatic doors towards us. The devotees cheered. "Welcome back, Swami," I said. "We have a car waiting for you." I pointed toward the exit doors, and everyone accompanied him to the parking lot before they made their way back to the temple in their own cars. We drove the Swami to Jamuna and Gurudas's three-room apartment on Willard Street, about 2 blocks from the temple. They had volunteered to give the Swami their home. Although it was up a steep hill, it had large windows and lots of light, and was by far the nicest apartment that any of the devotees rented. About 20 of us, all the devotees who had been around for the Swami's first visit, crowded into his rooms. He set his suitcase down and sat beside it on a large patterned cushioned carpet in Jamuna's living room. "I have gifts for you," he said, opening the brass clips on his suitcase. "I want to give you each a sari." He reached inside, pulled out a big colorful stack of folded cotton. "Janaki, come," he said. She came forward and he gave her a forest green sari with a white yellow border. "Thank you," she said, looking overwhelmed. "Thank you." "Harsharani, you are here?" he asked. "Yes," she called from the back of the room. She was 18 years old and had been initiated just before the Swami had left San Francisco. She came forward to receive her pale blue sari. "Thank you, Swami," she said. One by one, he called out the names of each woman, and they each came forward to receive their gift. For most of them, these were the first real saris they had ever owned. Malati, the Swami said, where is she? They're still in jail, I said, a little too loudly. The Swami's look of happiness vanished, like letters on a chalkboard wiped away with a wet cloth. Oh, I remember, he said quietly, looking down blankly at the pile of saris in his lap. I have a letter that Shyamasundar has written for you, Gurudas said. He handed the letter to the Swami, who tore open the envelope and read it with a serious look on his face. Then he broke into a smile. He says his return to San Francisco will be like an arrow quivering in its target, he reported. They are chanting whole day. This is very nice. He placed the letter beside him on the bed and turned his attention back to us. And you, he asked, you are all chanting? Murari, you are chanting 16 rounds each day? Yes, every day. Jayananda, you are chanting 16 rounds? Yes, Swami, I am, he said. The Swami went around the room and asked each person this question. It was clear to me that this was the most important issue for him, whether or not we were chanting Hare Krishna. When he came to Annapurna, a 17-year-old from England, she turned bright red and was silent. The Swami waited. Half a minute went by. She looked up at the light fixture in the ceiling and then back at the Swami. I chant, she blushed and faltered, swallowed, paused, and tried again. I chant. Her British accent and childlike tone made everyone giggle quietly. She pronounced chant so that it rhymed with the word gaunt. She blinked her eyes rapidly and finally said, sometimes I chant more than 16 rounds. Her voice cracked on the word more. The Swami gently said, that's all right. Come take this sari. He gave her the yellow sari on the top of the pile, and Annapurna looked self-consciously around the room and gave a sigh of relief. I handed the Swami the white box containing the kartals. We made some kartals, I said. He opened the box and held them by their soft red handles. We made 100 sets. We're selling them. Where were they made? He asked. Right here, in South San Francisco. He unfolded the blue instruction sheet and read it without expression. Then he clanged the kartals together and listened to the sound, his head slightly cocked to one side. He rang them together and looked upon us into the dining room and listened until they stopped ringing. Not so great, he said thoughtfully, gazing at me. He reached into his bag and pulled out a small cloth containing a set of slightly larger kartals. He then rang them together. That is great, he said, opening his eyes wide. I was a bit disappointed, even though I knew from the beginning that our kartals would never sound as good as genuine Indian ones. Now I will take some rest, the Swami said. A few days later, I picked up Shyamasundar and Malati from the airport. A mutual friend of ours had heard they were being released and called to let me know. How did you know we needed to be picked up? Malati said. Judy told me. It's great to see you guys, I said. This is all so amazing, Shyamasundar exclaimed. We both got released just yesterday. I didn't know she was getting out, and she didn't know I was getting out, and we both ended up at Judy's house, and now you're here. And the Swami's in San Francisco, I said, knowing this would be the icing on the cake for them both. I can't wait. Yeah, staying at Gurudas and Jamuna's. Let's go see him. I know he'll want to see you. On the way to the Swami's apartment, Shyamasundar and Malati told me about their time in jail. It was a violent place, Shyamasundar said. Actually, it wasn't so bad where I was in the women's jail, Malati added, but I just tried to keep to myself as much as possible. Yeah, and we both tried to chant as much as we could, Shyamasundar said. The whole time I was in there, I was thinking about the ways we could help the Swami spread the word about Krishna consciousness. And I've got a great idea. It's foolproof. I was immediately wary. Shyamasundar's foolproof ideas were inclined to be anything but. Yeah, I said, what's your idea? Well, I thought we should try to get famous people interested. Everyone pays attention to what they say, right? I guess so, I answered. They do, he insisted. If famous people become devotees, Krishna consciousness will spread like wildfire. That was Swami speak. I knew. I'd heard the Swami use the word wildfire in the same context a number of times, and I'd even found myself using it occasionally. It'll spread when everyone sees them being devotees, Shyamasundar said. Sounds great, I said sarcastically. Now all you need is some famous people. I thought of that, Shyamasundar said. Who's more famous than anyone else and the most famous people in the world right now? Names and faces flashed through my mind. Lyndon Johnson? Frank Sinatra? The Pope? The Beatles, Shyamasundar exclaimed triumphantly. And the great thing is that they're already into mysticism and Indian stuff. We know that they know about our movement because they ordered 300 copies of the New York Devotees Happening album. So they've already heard the Swami chanting, and now all we have to do is go to England and meet them. It sounds like a bit of a pipe dream, I said. How many people arrive in London's airport every day hoping to catch a look at the Beatles? It's not like John Lennon's just sitting around waiting for people to turn up and make friends. We can do it, he said, undeterred by my negativity. I'm sure we can. If Krishna wants it, it'll happen. I'm going to talk to the Swami about it. When we arrived at Jamuna's apartment, Malati stuck her head round the door to the Swami's bedroom. The Swami looked up and smiled broadly. Come in, come in, he said exuberantly. I was thinking last night when you would come, and now you are here. Go to my suitcase. I have brought sari for you. And he presented Malati with a beautiful rose-pink sari, which she wore until it was in shreds. Within the first week of the Swami's stay in San Francisco, we paid a visit to the U.S. Immigration Office downtown to try to get him a permanent residence status. He had been writing to me about this when he was in India, and I made some initial investigations, but I thought if we went down there in person, we might be able to make an impact and get the visa approved faster. We took the elevator to the 14th floor of a big glass building. We were shown through to a small office by the young receptionist who greeted us from the front desk. Inside the office, a matronly woman with tired blue eyes and dyed blonde hair sat behind the desk as she had been waiting for us. She gestured for us to sit in the two chairs opposite her. You are with the Hare Krishnas? She was polite and even friendly, but in a distant, businesslike way. Yes, I said, nodding proudly. So what can I help you with? We'd like to get a permanent visa for the Swami, I said. This is Swami Bhaktivedanta. He's just returned from India to continue with his mission to start an international spiritual movement. I can take your application, she said. Do you have the forms? She opened the filing cabinet to her left and flicked through the compartment tabs. I had expected this kind of polite dismissal, so I had another tactic up my sleeve. I heard there's a special type of visa for culture, I said. She paused and then closed the filing cabinet drawer. You know, for people who write books, paint, play instruments, and sing or dance. Couldn't we apply for him in that category? Has he won any prizes, like, you know, Pulitzer or anything like that? She asked. I thought it was strange how she continued to address me rather than the Swami, almost as though he wasn't there or couldn't understand what she was saying. Prizes? Any kind of prizes, she repeated, like a Pulitzer Prize or a Nobel Prize. Well, he presented his books to the Prime Minister of India. I have a photo of that, I said. I knew this was grasping at straws, but it was better than nothing. Any books on a bestseller list in this country, she asked. I don't think so, but he sold thousands. I thought that that would count for something. Immigration and naturalization would need to have certificates, she said. I mean certificates for how many books have been sold. So can he apply under that category using the photos, I asked. She glanced at the Swami. He can try, she said doubtfully, but I can't promise anything. The Swami spoke for the first time. I am here under visitor's visa, he said, and it has been renewed 2 times. So now I want permanent visa. You can issue? No, but I can take your application, she said congenially. We knew, of course, that she could take an application form. I felt like she was patronizing us. Why are there so many tall buildings if there are earthquakes here? The Swami asked. Why was he asking such a question now? Oh, this building is earthquake-proof, she assured him. She absently shuffled a pile of typed documents on her desk and then looked up at the Swami with an expression of curiosity on her face. "Isn't it hard to always remember Krishna?" she asked. Again, I was surprised. I thought, how does she know about Krishna and how important it is to try to think of him? "It's just like you put clothes on in the morning," the Swami said. "You would never go to work without clothes, isn't it?" "No, never," she said. "So it's natural, like getting dressed. You can also." "Also what?" she asked. "Remember Krishna always," he answered. "I don't know," she said. She looked reflectively out the huge windows toward the building across the street and then opened the filing cabinet drawer and selected a form. "Fill in your application," she said briskly, handing me the thick form. Looking at me again seriously, she said, "Make sure you fill in all the spaces on the form so it won't get sent back." I quickly scanned the form to see what was required. The Swami leaned forward and read it with me. "And be sure it's signed," she said, a note of finality in her voice. This was obviously the end of the interview. "Is there anything else you want to say, Swamiji?" I asked. I'd heard other people call him Swamiji, using the suffix G on the end of his name as a sign of affection. It was the first time I had ever addressed him in this way, and I felt a bit self-conscious. I glanced at the Swami and saw that his gaze was directed at her, not at me. "Isn't there another kind of form we can take?" I asked. "Here," she said, looking sorry for us. "Take one of these." I glanced down and saw it was the application for the special cultural visa. "All right, let us go," the Swami said. "Thank you very much," he said to the woman. "You're welcome," she chimed. "Good luck." We took the elevator down to the ground. As we walked toward the car, the Swami pointed his cane toward a neon sign above a doorway across the street. "Cocktail bar." "What is this word, cocktail?" he asked. "It's a drink of whiskey mixed with a soft drink," I said. "What is soft drink?" "It is non-alcoholic drink that is usually carbonated," I said. "But in a cocktail, it's mixed with alcohol." He nodded, and we walked silently another half block. As we reached the Krishna car, he said sarcastically, "There is no such thing as earthquake proof." We pulled away from the immigration office. A block or so on, we came upon a large group of shouting people outside a big Crown Zellerbach building. They walked back and forth, carrying signs that said, "Stop hiring scabs," "Workers wage torture," and "Local union liars." "What is this?" the Swami asked. "It's some kind of demonstration or protest," I said. I couldn't get a look at the protesters since I was driving, but I knew there was still a lot of draft protests. There were now a lot of major celebrities taking part in them, and some had even been arrested recently during a special nighttime march to the Pentagon. "Always somebody is protesting," he murmured. He looked over at me. "You will come to help me fill in this form tomorrow?" "I can come after the morning program," I said. "That will be very nice," the Swami said. The following morning, I went to the Swami's apartment to fill in the papers with him as we'd arranged. I sat down on the woven square rug in the Swami's apartment to browse the forms and to figure out all the requirements. "I think it's best if we apply under the ordinary category," I said, flickering through the notes provided for applicants. Without being a celebrity, the chances of getting residency under the special category looked pretty dim to me. I could see the permanent residency issue was not going to be solved anytime soon. When I looked up at him for his approval, I saw that the telephone wires outside were bobbing up and down. The windows began to rattle, and I saw the floor tilt a few degrees. I froze in fear. "What is this?" asked the Swami. "It's an earthquake," I said softly, my heart pounding like a jackhammer in my chest. The apartment was on a sharply rising street, and an earthquake could easily demolish the whole house and send us hurtling to the ground 40 feet below. The Swami leaned back and broke out into a relaxed smile. "This sound is similar like an air raid attack," he said. "I was in an underground bomb shelter in Calcutta, and I think it was 1942. There was an air attack. The walls, floors, and windows stopped shuddering. I sighed in relief, but the Swami kept talking. "Then I was thinking how nice it would be to die now while I'm thinking about Krishna," he said calmly, as if oblivious to the potential disaster that had just struck. I was amazed at the contrast between the sobriety that he had and my fear. The disastrous San Francisco earthquake of the early 20th century had shown the potential magnitude of earthquakes. Earthquakes equaled death, especially here, but the Swami was not afraid. I was reminded of the North Vietnamese Buddhist who reached out to touch a live hand grenade and commented right before he died, "It feels hot." The Bhagavad Gita says, if one is situated in Krishna consciousness, even in the terrible situation, fearful situation, he is not afraid, the Swami continued. When everything is normal, we are not afraid of death. But as soon as we find there is an earthquake and we are afraid of this building falling down, then we become very much disturbed. The Swami really knows he's not his body, I thought to myself. For me, it's just a theory, but he really lives his life by this. The next day, I found out that the earthquake registered 5.2 on the Richter scale and was the sharpest since the 5.3 quake of 1957. Apart from jolting my memory about the San Andreas Fault, which we were all living on, the quake also gave me a glimpse into the Swami's realized knowledge of the philosophy he was teaching.